We're going to start tonight with the Maharam Lublin. I hope we know who the Maharam Lublin is.
Maharam?
Maharam. That's the guy in the back of the Gemara.
There's a lot of guys in the back of the Gemara.
Probably the one called the Maharam.
See this one? It says Maharam on it.
Oh, yeah. The one I always just like look over and not really read?
Yeah.
That one.
That guy?
Yeah, okay.
He's in the back of the Gemara. He's under the Maharshal, which is fascinating.
Maharshal is fascinating.
Because he's really before the Maharshal.
He's before the Maharsha.
Yes, he is.
He's considered a. He's put in there as a commentary on the Maharsha.
No, he's not a commentary on the Maharsha. He's not a commentary on the Maharsha. Okay. The Maharam Lublin's name was Remeir ben Gedalia. He lived in 1558, from 1558 till 1660. He learned by Rabbi Yitzchak Shapira from Krakow, but I didn't. And he married his daughter. That's like there's two patterns. There's two basic patterns, two rabbinic patterns here. I mean, of course, there are exceptions to these patterns, but there's two basic patterns. One is the one who marries the rabbi slash Rosh Hashiva's daughter. Another one is the one who marries the daughter of the well-to-do supporter of Torah. Those are your two basic patterns.
Supporter of
Torah. I'd rather be the latter.
What? Say again? Yeah, sure. That we had last week. That we had last week. The Sma. We've heard of the Sma. Didn't you guys see a Sma? Didn't Rabbi David assign one of those like a week or two ago?
I think
this Sma, he assigned a Sma. Okay, the Sma is one of the basic Meforshim of Choshen Mishpat. He was a
They did call the Choshen Mishpat.
Okay, but he's a contemporary. He also wrote Prisha and Drisha. Maybe it was a Prisha he told you to learn, or a Drisha?
It was a Drisha.
Drisha, okay.
Prisha and Drisha.
It's the same thing. Prisha and Drisha. Prisha and Drisha and Sma, all written by the same person, Rishua HaKoyin, nicknamed Falk. They were contemporaries, and we'll get to that in a moment. The Maharam Lublin was a Rosh Hashiva in Lublin, and then he was a rabbi in Rosh Hashiva in Krakow, and in Limburg. Limburg, as mentioned last week, was originally called, that's what it's called by Jews, Limburg. Today it's called Lvov. Today it's called Lvov. Or Lviv. Today it's in.
Why do cities like change their names?
Why do cities change their names? So the answer is the cities have. I mean, cities' names change. So there's multiple answers. So I mean, I'm not quite a big enough expert in Slavic languages to say much about them. But many to know. In other words, in English. Almost all names, and certainly almost all city names, the vast majority of city names are nonsensical.
Yeah.
That means that they've lost whatever the original meaning was, is irrelevant to why it's called what it is. That is a general rule. I mean, there's some slight exceptions. New York, yeah, that's like sort of a slight exception, but the vast majority of city names in English have lost, in America and England, have lost connection to whatever they originally meant.
So like Phoenix, or like
Chicago. In America, it's of course more problematic because a large amount of names are of Indian origin.
Right, Milwaukee. Okay.
A very large amount. So it's very hard to know. It's admitting. It's fine. That's what we did last year during Night Seder.
Every night.
I don't know if he perfected it in Night Seder.
It looks like he did.
That's really talented.
Okay. Cities, names of cities. Why do they have multiple names? So, English names are very hard to know. You usually don't find it. I know, I can't remember what it was, but when I was in Poland this summer, we were asking the Poles. Yeah, it was in Poland in the summer.
Really?
How was it? It was nice. Kyiv, I mean, it's the nicest Poland will ever be. No, I'm a big proponent. I think it's an important thing for people to do. I know you're very American, but I still think it's an important thing for people to do. You know, it's only on one side, or part of one side, right?
Yeah.
And I don't remember where it was, but there'll be names. There'll be names. A name here, for example, Birkenau. You know what Birkenau is? Birkenau. What Birkenau is now? Birkenau, what's Birkenau?
It's one of the concentration camps.
Okay, that was, there's like Auschwitz 1 and Auschwitz 2 is called Birkenau. Why is it called Birkenau?
That was the town.
It's not just the town, because it was a very small little nothing. There were a lot of birch trees there. And a birch tree in German is Birken. Birken is a birch tree. Birkenau is like a city with birch trees. The name in Polish, I can't remember, don't ask me, I'll never be able to say it right, but a birch tree is in Polish. But the Poles, whenever the Germans will call something Birkenau, or Birk this, or Birkenfeld, or Birken this, or Birken the next, right? The Poles will say the Polish word for the same thing. So I don't know in Lemberg, if Lemberg and Lvov is Lvov, I don't know what Len means exactly in German. Is Len merely the Polish version of that? Or it's more complicated. In other words, Yaakov, Jack, John. Same thing, right?
Where I thought John was Yochanan.
I don't know why John is considered Jack, but it is. Okay. Anyway, so that's why there is very variant names. Some of them are just.
Berkovitz means something. Does that have to do with like?
Does Berkovitz mean something? Fitz means son of. Burke. I don't know. That's a good question.
Son of a birch tree.
Son of a birch tree. I don't know. Someone from Birken. That's a good question. You're asking a good question. Okay. Okay. Let's get back to where we were. He was in Rabbanus in Limburg, and there was communal conflict between the Maharam and the Sma. There was communal conflict between the Maharam and the Sma. Now the Sma, last week, we saw that the Sma was married to the daughter of a very well-to-do Baal Bos, very well-to-do person in Lemberg. Okay. And I, even though, of course, I have no way to substantiate this, but logic tells us that the reason why the Sma won the communal conflict and the Maharam lost it was because the Sma had superior local contacts. So he was married to a local girl, he knew all the locals, his father-in-law was well connected to everybody, and that logic tells us that that's why the Sma was the one who won this communal conflict and the Maharam lost the communal conflict and had to leave.
What was their
conflict? I'm not sure. This did not feel like it was worth figuring out what the argument was about. But what I will say is my editorial comment. There's a not so well known letter of the Rambam. It took him time last year. You know how many times you can listen to my shiur and my shiur, pens dropping. So that's Yossi learning how to do the thing. Now he's so good, it never happens. Okay. The Rambam in a not so well known letter. The Rambam in a not so well known letter explains. I hold this is one of the keys to understanding the Rambam, the Shittas Rambam among about a lot of things. Rambam explains why he did not want to get involved in communal issues, in the larger communal societal issues. The Rambam in a not well known letter, he says, when you're dealing with this society at large, then you're dealing with the masses, and the masses don't know anything. And they think which rabbi is more important and knows more, one who has a longer, whiter beard, you know, he doesn't say wears a blacker coat, but okay, it's not as long by a coat, and has more chumras. That's probably the better rabbi. And the Rambam says it more or less. So this is an old problem, and this is why the Rambam did not want to get involved in communal issues, because the ideal of Malchus Beis David and the ideal ruler is not working right at this point in time, then you are by force subject to society at large. And society at large has no way to understand how to quantify real substance. It's like, this is in the middle of a letter the Rambam has, where someone asked his advice about who should be a Rosh Yeshiva in Bavel, in Baghdad. And the people who were arguing with the Rambam were almost completely unknown. It's not like it was Rabbeinu Tam over there arguing the Rambam. It's someone who has known of major substance. The main thing known about him is he argued with the Rambam. And it's like if he wanted to argue with the Rambam, he'd be a completely unknown person. And the Rambam is the Rambam. But at the time, the masses over there were not aware of that. They weren't aware the Rambam was the Rambam. I said, okay, we have our rabbis too. Right? He's got a nice red beard, doesn't he? Okay, so
that definitely has to be the reason, because the Rambam did not have a lot of kulos.
No, okay, whatever, not now. The issue of chumras and kulos is not really pertinent over here. I only brought it in as a side point, so I'm not going to speak about that issue. I had, the year before your brother's year, I had a great discussion with my night seder about how to translate the word chumra. We did that last year? How to translate the word chumra?
We did it
once.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, that I try to do at least once a year. But the year before your brother's Yagamim got such the greatest answers ever. Yeah. Okay. Fine. Vaitra. So that's not part of the topic here. So we can dangle. If you want, you can either ask me later, ask me over dinner, or whatever. Fine. But so the Maharam went back to Lublin and became Rabbi of Sheshiva in Lublin for the last, let's say, 5 to 8 years of his life. Made major improvements to the yeshiva there. And this is when he had his famous Talmidim like the Shlo, who we may or may not get to tonight. No, we'll get to. He's the next on the topic. Who we'll get to, the Shlo. This is when the Shlo and other famous Gedolei Achronim learned by him, was when he was in his last, you know, number of years of his life, Rabbi and Rosh Yeshiva Lublin. Okay, it's fascinating that the Maharam was an opponent of accepting Shulchan Aruch as real final psak in Halacha, Shulchan Aruch and Ramah. Which, I mean, it's important to keep it in perspective. I'm mentioning it because you shouldn't think, you know, the point's like this. You shouldn't think, today we don't really question the authority of Shulchan Aruch, basically. I mean, that's of course a slight oversimplification. To say that we don't accept, that we don't, you know, doubt the authority of Shulchan Aruch. So that's a slight oversimplification, of course, but just slight. But the point in the greater, you know, broader spectrum is you shouldn't think that any part, any, you know, major work, any something which became entrenched in Yiddishkeit was just accepted blindly by everyone at the time, because it's not true. It wasn't true with the Rambam, it's not true with Shulchan Aruch. I mean, it's also important to realize that the Maram Lublin was practically the contemporary of the Machaber and Ramah. I mean, they were a generation and a half or so older than him, but that's not, you know, that's basically contemporaries. That's basically contemporaries. And as a result, he wasn't really obligated to accept their psak as a final psak, and he didn't. Okay. Okay, what's the Maharam most famous for? Of course, he's most famous for his papers on Tosis. It's not only on Tosis. It's primarily on Tosis. Tosis, as we know, is cryptic and difficult.
And an understatement.
What?
And an understatement.
Yeah, you think that's understated. So the question, of course, is, so why do we learn Tosis if it's so difficult? You know, the Ritva is a lot easier to learn.
A lot.
What, right? The Ritva is easier to learn. It would be much easier to learn the Ritva, right? It would. And there were people, the Maharal and the others, who said, what are you printing Tosis on the page for? No one understands it. Print the Ritva on the page of the Rashba or the Rosh, no, not clear. So the answer to that, and I spoke about this last year at great length, the answer is the Tosis and Ki'il invented the system of thought.
System of what?
System of thought. The system of thought and analysis that we see in Tosis. So why is it we learn Tosis if Tosis is so difficult? Tosis is difficult. Why do we learn Tosis? The answer is Tosis Ki'ilu invented.
The Lamdish.
It's not just Lamdish. Tosis invented that style of analysis in a clear fashion, more than anyone else. That's what we learn Tosis. That's why it's printed on the page.
Maybe he follows up Gemara like.
Basically, Tosis echoes the logic of Gemara is echoed clearly in the Tosis. Tosis Ki'ilu applies the Gemara's style of thought to the Gemara itself. Not that Rashi didn't. I spoke about all these things last year at length. Not that Rashi didn't have that knowledge and understanding, because he certainly did. But Tosis does it in a much more open fashion. And that's why we learn Tosis. That's why we learn Tosis.
Most Rishonim don't really like learn that way. Tosis deals with like, very technical like questions, bringing up steers.
Yeah.
A lot of Rishonim don't really
learn
that way.
Yes and no, you're oversimplifying.
More Achronim than
mostly the Rishonim. Most of the Rishonim echo most of Tosfos' problems most of the time. Most of the Rishonim, the Ritva and the Rajva, we don't have Rajva on Lankas, but the Ritva is a much clearer writer, Akiva, than Tosfos. But still, nonetheless, Tosfos are people who started the approach. That's what we learned. The Maharam wrote his Perish basically on Tosfos. The Maharam, and we're not going to get to the Marshal for a week or two, wrote his Perish as a commentary, as like a running commentary, an explanation on Tosfos. Unlike, we'll see, we'll get to the Marshal in a week or two, and I'll tell you what I understand about the Marshal's style. The Maharam is written as a running commentary. It is very clear, much more clear than the Maharsha and the other Mefarshei Tosfos. Now, the other Gedolei Acharonim, classic Gedolei Acharonim and Tosfos, are the Pnei Yeshua, Chavnei Shlomo, all these people. No, the Ritva is a Rishon. All these later Acharonim.
What's your opinion on the Ritva of Makos? Apparently, there's some people who think the Ritva of Makos might not have been Ritva.
I haven't seen anything clear about it, so I can't. I could look at the Hakdama to my Ritva I have, and see if anyone has anything intelligent to say.
So David had mentioned it in Shir because he said he never saw Ritva like he saw Ritva in Makos. Apparently, he just found it different.
Okay, whatever. I could discuss it with Rabbi David tomorrow. There's a known concept that there's Ritva Madura Kama and Ritva Madura Basra, which means. The Ritva is longer and shorter chidushim, and the assumption is he wrote the longer ones first and the shorter ones afterwards. On Sukkah, he's not quite as barichas as I'm not sure if I see it. I'm not sure. I have to see exactly why they think that. Anyway, now it's one day. The Maharam wrote running commentary on Tosfos, which is very important because he explains relatively clearly Tosfos' questions and his answers, and that's a major important point and step of, you know, gaining true competency in learning.
What drives these, like, these Acharonim and Rishonim to just, like, write these commentaries? Like, what, they just,
okay.
Like, they just get Ekman, and say, like, I want to write this.
Okay, no. So this is, now you're getting on to, you can get me to say what I would favor you to share on the statements. Okay. It's like this. I've said many times, some things are simple, and I'm done to make them complicated. And other things are complicated, and it's not the Ramdanu's fault. Okay, that's half a joke, okay? What's driving the Rishonim and Acharonim to say what they say?
So, that's just that. No, more like, you know, it's like, okay, there's lots of things to talk about, and lots of things, like, there's so much stuff, like, why he's like, okay, I'm going to write on Tosfos.
No, I sort of explained. Should I go back over why the importance of what Tosfos is very important? Tosfos are, you understand why someone would want to write on Tosfos?
Huh?
Do you understand why someone would want to write on Tosfos?
Yeah, but it's like,
That's the skills, that's the keys. I mean, the facts are like this also, it's important to understand. Today, we have a base midrash full of Rishonim. Back in 200 years ago, 300 years ago, 500 years ago, they didn't have any Rishonim. They had a Gemara, Rashi, Tosfos. They had a Rambam, they had a Tur, they didn't have much else.
Right.
They did not have ready access to the Rishonim the way we do. That's A. But even more than that, again, Tosfos were the inventors of the style of thought. And because they're the inventors, they're very important to understand how they work and how they go through the Sugya. The bottom line of everything. And this, I think I spoke about a little last week. And maybe when we get back to it this week, I don't think I will. But we'll get back to it next week, I think. The bottom line of everything is the Sugya. You understand what that means? The Sugya is what it says in Gemara. That you can't argue with. No one can argue with it.
Right.
You can argue with Rashi. You know, I hear as a friend of mine says, I don't know exactly who he's quoting, but there's a friend of mine once told me years ago, he's a couple years older than me, and he says, quoting one of his Rebbeim, whatever. I know where he learned, but I'm not sure who's exactly quoting. So if you argue with the Rishon, you're crazy. You don't argue with Rashi, but like Rishon. You're at what?
Unless you have another Rishon.
Yeah, that's not called arguing with Rashi. I mean, there's two things. A is you can't, you know, however shver, however difficult Rashi may be, however difficult Rashi may be, it's still a piece of Torah. It's still mamish, absolutely part of Torah. It's not possible to disprove Rashi. It's not possible for us to disprove Tosfos. You can't do that. We don't have, we are beyond our competency level to attempt to do that. But again, for Gedolei Achronim have the ability, they will say, okay, Rashi says this, most Rishonim argue, forget about Rashi, don't worry about Rashi, you don't have to worry about Rashi. You can, okay, sometimes it's, life's more complicated, I don't want to get into many specifics, but the only thing, the thing what is obligatory, which you can't argue with, that's the Gemara. And the very basics of understanding the Gemara are Rashi and Tosfos. If you understand Rashi and Tosfos, then you're moving. I tell you, the Rashi is not really moving. Okay, so what's motivating? What's motivating now? A sugya gets life to itself, as it could be said. Once X amount of achronim develop an issue, everyone else is going to come and say, okay, that's probably what's important to talk about. And talk about that also. Now that's like again, this is somewhat of an oversimplification, but that is more or less how things work. Clear? We're basically clear. Okay, fine. Okay, let's go on to the Shla. The Shla's name was Rabbi Shaya Horowitz. His father's name was Avram.
He was a Levi?
He was a Levi, that's right. 1560 to 1630.
Is he the person that says turkeys are not kosher?
I doubt it.
That's the Horowitz thing, right?
It may be. But it's very difficult. Okay, turkey, remind me to get back. First I want to speak about the name Horowitz, and then you ask me about turkeys being kosher or not, and I'll tell you why it does not make any sense to be the Shlo. But let's go step by step.
Bring up Thanksgiving time.
We're getting closer, don't worry, I eat turkey. I know people who don't eat turkey, but I eat turkey.
Really?
Absolutely. Okay.
American.
Okay. Horowitz. The phenomenon of last names, which I started speaking about last week, as we may know, is for Ashkenazi Jews relatively recent. Ashkenazi Jews were forced to take last names depending on the country, sometime between the late 1700s to the early 1800s. Now the Horowitz last name is known from at least 1500, if not even before 1500. Which makes it an big exception to the rule. Okay. Now, again, as it's not, I don't know if someone got this one quite right, but the Shla called himself Ish Horowitz, a man of Horowitz, which is like, what? Witz means son of. Horo, what in the world is Horo? Harry? I mean, what is it exactly? I don't know. You know, let's see. What is it? Now, we also do know, as Berkowitz said, that most Horowitzes are Levim. There are a minority who are not Levim, but the majority are Levim. And usually the ones who are Levim say they're descended from the Shlo.
They say that, like, specifically?
Yes, they do. Absolutely do. Okay, Horowitz family tradition says that they're really descended from the Baal HaMa'or.
I'll have to ask my little Levi Horowitz friends.
Okay, ask them. See how much they know about it. Horowitz family tradition says they're descended from the Baal HaMa'or, and the family was expelled from Spain, went from Spain to Italy, from Italy to Prague, from Prague to a little city outside of Prague
Spain
called... that's not clear. I wasn't able to do quite the amount of research I would like, and the question is, when did they leave Spain? Did they leave Spain in 1391 or 1492? Those are the two ways of Jews leaving Spain, 1391, 1492. Either way, they got to a place, Horowice. Horowice is in Bohemia, / the Czech Republic, near Prague, and they adapted the last name. Now, this is sort of an answer. This is the answer to this mystery of why in the world do they have a last name when most Ashkenazi don't have last names for hundreds of years. And the answer is because they come from a Sephardi background. And Sephardim adopted last names much earlier than Ashkenazi. Because they came from a Sephardi background, they adapted a last name, and that also last week we were discussing and theorizing if Reb Mordechai Yaffe, if the Yaffe family, Yaffe family, may originate, if they would originate from Spain, that would also explain why they have a last name hundreds of years before anyone else does. Because this is a historical anomaly. What in the world does this guy have a last name when no one else has a last name? It was not accepted at all. The last name was Ben so and so. I mean, the people who you think had last names, like the Rabbah, people think his last name is Israelis. It's not Israelis, it's Israels. His father's name was Yisrael, and a nickname for Yisrael in Hebrew and Yiddish is Isser. And it's Israels, means son of Isser. Okay? And in Mechen Hara, there are plenty of other supposed last names are the same exact thing.
Like Rabbi Isser Zalmelzer?
No, yeah, well, Isser is like the same name, Yisrael. But Isser is a Yiddishism for Yisrael. It's a Yiddishism for Yisrael.
My last name is so boring.
Say again?
My last name is so boring.
Oh, Ackerman? Why is that so boring?
It means corner man. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, okay, well, the question is...
My ancestors were drug dealers.
Well, no, the question is where was your great-great-great-great-grandfather from? Was he from Germany? Was he from Austria? Where was he from?
He's from Germany.
That's the question. Okay, should we get to turkeys now? You're back. I'll explain turkeys very briefly. I don't believe that the shlaw could be the source of not eating turkey. There's a well-known Eastern European custom, a minority custom, not to eat turkey. There was a humpbacked cow issue about 5 to 8 years ago. And it was very in the vogue, whatever, the Mishpacha magazine? Mm-hmm. The Mishpacha magazine, you've seen it? Yes, you've seen the Mishpacha magazine? Okay, so they had people in South America taking pictures of the cows, almost all meat in Israel from South America. Right?
Right.
It's sort of like my old Mechavrissa from Hilchas Brachas, who grew up in Borough Park, Mamash, says, as far as he's concerned, tomato grows in a box in New Jersey. He doesn't know what a tomato looks like. He has no idea what the plant looks like. Fine. So Israelis don't know what cattle look like. Cattle come in these boxes from South America, right? So some of the shoftim took pictures of these cattle in South America, and some of the Mishpacha magazine got a hold of them. They had humps, and they are cattle, and they're not cattle, and genetically, and this, that, and the next. And a famous story with the Chazanish. I should tell you the story of the Chazanish.
Yeah,
the story of the Chazanish. Okay. Back in the beginning of the Medina, they were looking for cheap meat. And they didn't have, in order to grow, in order to raise cattle, you need a lot of grazing space. Right? There are people in South America and Brazil and Argentina who have ranches larger than the state of Israel.
No way.
Or like half the size, yeah, seriously. Yeah, because there's no one there, it's not worth that much. You know?
They brought in Texans to get in the set of the ranches in Israel. The Texans were like, these are so small, like, we have ranches in Texas that, like, you drive for days and you're still on the ranch.
That's right. So the point is they were looking for cheap meat, and they sent people to Madagascar, and there was something called a zebu, and the zebu chews its cud and has split hooves. But no one has quotes of Masor, no one has tradition about it.
I thought it doesn't matter with animals.
So the Chazanish came out against it that you shouldn't do it. And I'm not going to get into all the. There's something called practical rabbinics. Practical rabbinics. And practical rabbinics mean that that even if something's technically mutter, that doesn't mean you should always do it. So the Chazanish specifically was worried when the state of Israel started, there was a lot of talk about Kiwi trying to start a Sanhedrin and all sorts of things like this, because I was extremely nervous about. Because, again, back to the public forum. The public forum in Israel is not controlled by religious people at all. It's controlled by anti-religious people. And he was very concerned that things would get very out of hand. So he came out very against the Zebu. And so that was a whole big tumult with this. And that gets us on to turkeys. Wait, where did turkeys come from?
USA.
The USA. Okay, does anyone know what they're called in Yiddish? I doubt it. Does anyone know what they're called in Yiddish?
Turkey.
No, in Yiddish they call it... What?
It sounds like another bird also.
No, but it does. It sounds very familiar. In Yiddish they're called an English hen. An English chicken. Why are they called an English chicken? Because where did they come from? The English colonies. When was the colony of Virginia founded? Come on, let's see who knows their American history here.
1692.
The British colonies. The British colonies in Virginia were founded in the early 1600s. They attempted in the 1500s and were not successful. In the early 1600s, when practically they were successful. That's when they were practically successful. I find it almost impossible, if not absolutely impossible, that the English hun, that the English chicken, made it from the British colonies alive to Eastern Europe by 1630. And especially as the Schlag, we're not, I don't know if we're going to go, maybe we'll get there this week. The Schlag left Europe in 1625. I think it's almost a physical impossibility. So that the Schlag is the source of the custom not to eat turkey, I find extremely difficult and probably not, you know, like I can't say it's absolutely impossible and completely not true, but I find it extremely, highly unlikely and really most likely, like 99% not true.
So do you eat turkey,
Rabbi? Yes, I eat turkey. The majority of people eat turkey. There's a minority, as I said earlier, there's a minority custom amongst Jews of Polish, Lithuanian, Belarusian, Ukrainian, Hungarian descent. There's a minority, not very high minority. Like, it's not like some things you've like sort of heard of. And other things is like you've never heard of. This one I've heard of. Like, I know, yeah, if I ask a friend of mine, he'd say, yeah, so-and-so doesn't eat, and so-and-so doesn't eat. It's like, you know, Herschel Schechter doesn't eat milk in America. You know that we're aware of that?
Only in America.
That could be here. I'm not sure what he does in America.
Do you have any milk in America?
Three cows.
What?
Nope.
No, nothing to call him. Still, he holds all the cows in America, or trefas.
Yeah.
And okay, he knows everyone argues with him.
One cow of trefas. And it wouldn't be a problem if you milk each cow into a separate bucket, because then you have roof. But the second, but the machines, how they work is they milk each cow into one big container. And therefore you don't have roof anymore, you have like bottled shishim or something like that. And therefore it's not 1/10 anymore. It's not, it has to be.
Okay, whatever, I don't know. It's been a couple of years since I schmoozed with the son about it.
You're
so it's hard to remember.
Here.
Yeah, I will. You're right.
Have a debate.
I'm not holding enough in the issue to debate about.
Is still turkey in Israel?
Yes, definitely still turkey in Israel. The Badat Eidech Haredes gives a Hashav Shkacha on turkey. Okay, right. That's Baz from the Shechiga. Okay. His father, the Shlach's father's name was Avram. He was also known Talmud Chacham, but he's best known for, which you don't quite have here, but what he's best known for, the Rambam wrote a preface to Pirkei Avos. Do we know what that's called?
Pirkei Avos.
The Rambam's Hakdama, the Hakdama, the Rambam's introduction to Pirkei Avos. It's called Shmona Prakim. Shmona Prakim. You've heard of Shmona Prakim, maybe?
Yeah.
Hopefully, okay. Shmona Prakim, and the Shlach's father, Rabbi Avram Hurwitz, wrote a parish called Chesed Avram, printed in the standard Shas. If you look in the standard Shas, open up, and the one with Avos, with Pirkei Avos, will have the Rambam there. And before the Rambam, before the Pirkei Avos, it'll have Shmona Prakim, and on the bottom, it has something called Chesed Avram. That's written by the Shlach's father. What?
You're a super commentary?
He wrote a commentary on the Rambam's commentary. The Rambam wrote a preface to Avos called Shmona Prakim.
That's not considered commentary?
It's commentary.
No, it's not. It's a preface.
It's commentary.
It's a preface.
Wow.
It's a preface. Okay.
If someone writes a preface on a preface, is that a super preface?
I don't think that's possible, but you never know. Okay, the Shlach initially learned by his father. Afterwards, he learned by the Maharam and the Sma and a number of others. His known rabbinic career started when he was 30, 1590. He was recorded in 1590 already as having signed on Takanas on decrees of the Vadar Arba Ratzos. We know what the Vadar Arba Ratzos is. I should remind everybody. Vadar Arba Ratzos was the Jewish autonomous body which made law and enforced law for Jew on Jew law in Poland. It was run by, it was like sort of partially democratic, partially oligarchical, partially theological. You know, all three different elements there. It's called Vad Arba Ratzos, the Council of the three, four, or five lands, depending on the year. So he signed on one of the takanas, one of the decrees In 1590, when he was 30 years old, which is pretty young, he served in Rabbanus as rabbi in a number of cities, which is typical, as mentioned last week and other weeks. The standard rabbinical contract in Eastern Europe at this time is a 3 to 5 year contract. It's not like today, each shul wants to have a rabbi for life, right? That's ideally, not always able to do that, but the ideal is you have a rabbi for life. But back in Poland, a long time ago, that's not how it worked. Shuls had 3 to 5 year contracts, and rabbis moved around a little bit, and some a lot, unless they were very famous and people were very interested in keeping them there. Okay. Okay. The Shlom being very typical, Ki'ilu, he was imported from Poland to Germany to be a rabbi in Germany. Like again, initially in the time of the Rishonim, Germany up until 1500, Germany and Prague, Germany and Bohemia were like Torah centers, and they sent rabbis to Poland. After 1500, the shoe's on the other foot, and the later you get, it's even more true that the center of Torah learning is in Poland. And typically, the Shema moves from Poland to Frankfurt. He was a rabbi in Frankfurt for about 8 years, at which, you know, as mentioned other weeks, there was a lot of turmoil, and Jews in Germany at this point in time were very insecure. Real German Jewry, we're going to speak about that in about 3 or 4 weeks, the beginning of real modern German Jewry as having real substance really starts in the 30 Years' War, a little after this.
Didn't it start with, like
No, no. There were Jews in Germany for over 1,000 years, at least that we know of. But in terms of continuity, in terms of substance, in terms of real substance, the Jews were almost turned out of all of Germany, excluding ecclesiastic states and a couple of free states, by 1550. There were very few Jews in Germany at this point in time. And this was 1600, there were very few Jews in Germany. Very few. And there were the Germany gained substance as a major place for Jews is really a new modern occurrence, starting with the 30 Years' War. And again, we'll get there in two weeks, maybe four weeks. We'll get there when we get to 30, when we start talking about more modern developments. We'll get back to that and I'll explain that. Okay. There was, again, he was expelled from Frankfurt in 1614 approximately, went on to Prague. He was in Prague for 7-8 years. In 1621, he decided to move to Israel. His children weren't so happy with the idea. This is like, I'm not sure if this is the first known, example of family conflict over whether someone should move to Israel or not. But, that's like, like stereotypical problem. Yeah, I would love to move to Israel, but my family's just not here, right? This is like a well-known issue. It's a well-known issue. So one of the first examples of this is the Shema. The Shema said, sorry guys, I'm moving. Goodbye. Okay, fine. So as a result of that, he wrote a famous sefer, which he's best known for, which is Shnei Luchos Habris. Shnei Luchos Habris. That's why he's called the Shema. Shnei Luchos Habris. See? Shua. That's why he's known as the Shua. It literally means the two tablets of the covenant. It's an ethical will. We heard we were by Rav Benny's Levaya. We heard his ethical will was pretty short compared to the Shua, or two. In the classic version, it's two volumes this size, double columned, small print. That's right. That's serious, man. That's serious.
That's his ethical will?
That's his ethical will.
How long was the Levaya?
It took him years. They didn't read the whole thing by the Levaya. It took him years to write it, at least 5 years, if not longer. It took him years to write. He started writing in Prague before he left.
What does it consist of? Like,
it goes through the entire day, the entire year, the entire Chumash. Everything. Now, why is the Shlua very important? Because the Shlua traveled to Israel the hard way. The hard way means the land route. And he went through Damascus. And in Damascus, the guy who did this is actually a very common historian. Rabbi Goldworm, competent historian, but I think he missed the boat here. We know the Shalom was in Damascus, that's a known fact. We know that when he's in Damascus, different communities in Israel tried to all get him to come. He ended up coming to Yerushalayim. But more, I think, equally important is there was someone else living in Damascus at that time. That was Reb Shmuel Vital. Reb Shmuel Vital is Reb Chaim Vital's son. Reb Chaim Vital, as I hope we're aware, was the Ari's prime Talmud. And the main disseminator, the main person who explained the Ari's system of Kabbalah. Now, the Chaim Vital held there's a major machlokas amongst the Kabbalah, how much you should explain Kabbalah to the masses, and even to not the masses, even to is anyone who's basically commented or even Gemara fitting to teach Kabbalah or not. The Ari held not. And initially, that gets back, I spoke about this last year, like, Chaim Vital, argued to me about it. But, after the Ari died, Reb Chaim Vital went back to the Ari's concept of only teaching the Ari's teachings to people who he checked out very carefully before he did it. And even though the Ari was personally known, he was known that he existed. People knew about him in Eastern Europe, but his teachings were unknown. And when the Shlah got, when Reb Shai Horowitz, the Shlah, got to Damascus, it's impossible for me to believe that he didn't meet Reb Shmuel Vital there. And that's probably as far as he first started learning firsthand the Kisvei Ari, the Ari's writings. And a significant amount of the Ari's writings are incorporated into the Shlah. A significant amount. And the Shlah is one of the first times that the Kisvei Ari, that the Ari's ideas in Kabbalah hit Eastern Europe. And that is very, very important. Now, he went into Eretz, I just want to finish him off. I know I'm really going slightly over, but we have to finish him off. We got to, if you want to leave, you can leave. We want to finish him off. We have to finish off the Shlah, because that's what we got to do. We got this, I want like a little paragraph to finish off the Shlah. Okay. The Ottoman Empire at this time was somewhat on decline. After the great Sultans Suleiman, and maybe this historical question about who, you know, the ones before Suleiman were definitely great. The ones after, when there's historical argument about how great they were or not, certainly post 1600, they weren't as great. And there was a lot more anarchy. There's a lot more anarchy in the Ottoman Empire. And the result of the anarchy was there was, quote, what they called pashas. You ever heard of a pasha? No, it's not Russian. Pasha. Pasha.
It's not a program.
No. Pasha. The Pasha was like even the governor, that's Turkish for governor approximately, who was like in charge of the different whatever district he was in, or even a sub-district. They were called Pashas. Okay. So there was a lot of anarchy and violence in Eretz Yisrael and Israel at the time because it was the central government was a lot weaker. And even though the Shlah originally was in Yerushalayim, that's where he wanted to come, because he had the Ashkenazi community, but because of anarchy, he was held captive for at least 2 weeks. They asked for tremendous amounts of ransom. He left Yerushalayim. He was scared he'd be captured again. And they tried to get more money out of him, because they were money hungry. There's no one on top of them making sure that they played by the books. He ended up moving to Tveria. He spent the last 5 years of his life in Tveria. And that's why he's buried in Tveria near the Rambam's Kever.
Did we go there last year?
We may have. Not on the slot trip. But you may have gone there. And that's where he's buried, and Adkan, that's the end of the Shalfan.